Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Bradley M. Godfrey to The Rogue Historian. Brad's one of my favorite Civil War authors because he's just written so much about so many cool things. Antietam, Manassas, Gettysburg, you name it. He's written about a bazillion books on the Civil War. A couple of my favorites, The Artillery at Gettysburg. Love that one. Brigades of Gettysburg. I love that one, too, because I'm kind of a nut about putting brigades on the battlefield, which brings me to my next point, The Maps of Gettysburg, one of my favorite books that I always have open when I'm reading one of the great military historians of the war, like Fonz or Coddington or any of these guys. I have this open alongside so I can follow along with the battle as it unfolds on a map. I'm a map geek. What are you going to do? So, hey, listen to the show. By all means, subscribe to this podcast and go to KeithHarrisHistory.com to see a lot of cool stuff. All right. Peace. So there we go. Well, let's just introduce you now, Brad. This is it's great to see you, Brad Godfrey, author of a gazillion books on the Civil War. My favorite of which, and I don't like to pick favorites, but I'm going to anyway. My favorite of which, of course, are the map books. I'm a map nut, and and your books are great. And so, hey, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on, man. Good to see you.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Keith. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Let's get right into it. You have your background is really quite interesting. You didn't begin life as a your academic life as a Civil War historian. Where did you start out in the world?
Well, I was born and raised in Philly. My older brother was very interested in the Civil War, and that's where I really got my interest. You know, trying to emulate my older brother. And then when I became when I went off to college pre-med. I realized I didn't want to be a physician, but here I was in my senior year. I didn't want to start all over again. And so I decided, I think I might like to teach, and why don't I just give college a try? So I went straight on for my doctorate. And probably the first 12, 15 years of my life as an academician, not a whole lot in terms of Civil War. It was really around the 1990s that I said, what's in those books that I would lug around? I was in Savannah, Georgia. I was in the Twin Cities. I was in Iowa. You know, we moved around. And that's when I really started to get interested in writing about history. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I have a zoology background. And a lot of people I find who are writers, they're not professional historians. They are people like myself who have a love of history. What biology and science has taught me is critical thinking. Mm. And so I will look at issues in a way that maybe historians might not look at the same kind of way. Critical thinking is very important to me. It was constantly pounded into my head when I was a grad student. And so I think that's made me a better historian. But in terms of the map books, that is my passion as well. We're on the same page there, Keith.
Yeah, as far as critical thinking goes, I'm a high school teacher, and that's something that I stress every day. Beginning in the ninth grade, when I get kids fresh out of middle school, not really knowing much about really anything about how to be a student of history, really, other than they come into it sometimes, I think, believing that history is simply, you know, memorizing a series of names and dates that happened in a sequence. And then, of course, you understand, you kind of get the gist of the narrative. And right. I think a lot of students come in thinking that learning history is learning the narrative without the critical analysis. Yes. That's involved in history. And so in the ninth grade early on, I really, really hammer that home. And by the time my kids are seniors, they're grizzled critical thinking veterans. And that's I send great. Them off to college. Now I wonder what you think. I mean, we were talking before I started recording, and you work with teenagers a lot, you know, when you do battlefield tours and various other things. Do you think that there's an absence of critical thinking at the high school level these days and that we should focus more on that?
Oh, definitely, especially in the public schools. And I don't want to bash public schools. I think the teachers there are doing the best job they possibly can, but they are under so much societal pressure, and so much teaching to the test, and that, the tests, the statewide tests that these students have to take now are, there's a lot of pressure. And so in so many school districts, things like history are being de-emphasized in favor of, writing and, mathematics, et cetera, which are important. But, when I was a student, I took everything. Now, many school districts have really de-emphasized some of the other aspects of being a well-rounded person. So I don't think that, and I'm going to use a broad brush, I think typically public schools are not emphasizing it. I think private schools, I think are doing a much better job of it. I don't know about co when I was in college, I don't think, now this was in the 70s, so actually it was in the 60s and 70s, that's how old I am. I don't think that critical thinking was really something that was emphasized. And it wasn't really until I got into grad school that really it was started to, be pounded into me, and I developed those skills. But it's been something that I utilize every day in every part of my life. One of the things, though, that I see, and I don't want to get off on a tangent, but I'm just thinking about it now. I've written 19 books on the Civil War. So what I do is I give a lot of talks at Civil War roundtables, libraries, et cetera. And the thing that drives me crazy is when someone sits in their easy chair, and they want to tell, well, McClellan should have done this, or Meade should have done that, or, without really understanding the dynamics of what was going on in that at that time with this person. One of the books that is just coming out, I don't know if I should even do this, you probably can't even see it.
Race Potomac,
It's, yeah, but it's Race to the Potomac. Here is someone like Meade who's been vilified for not aggressively going after, Robert E. Lee. And I listen and I smile because I don't engage, I don't fight anymore. It's not worth debates. But, putting yourself in Meade's shoes, a novice army commander, his army's been beaten up pretty badly. He doesn't know what Lee is doing, where he's going, what his plans are. Is he going to get up on those mountains and have an ambush? And I think if I were him, I would say, maybe I need to be a little bit cautious. But you find people, or McClellan, oh, well, he was slow, he was methodical, he was not fit to command the army. And it's just, you need to understand who these people were, what the environment was that they were in. And I just don't like to pass judgment. I'm more, when I write, it's more along the lines of this is what happened and how it happened, and not getting into, well, he should have done this. And I've read books where I have to actually close them when there's a book on a certain aspect of Antietam. And well, he should have done that and he didn't do this. And it's like, no, you can't do that because you weren't there. You don't understand the dynamics of what was going on. So I'm a
You
little
know, that's
passionate.
that that's a that's a an extraordinarily good point, and something else that I think about with my students all the time is we have this tendency, I believe, especially from the vantage point of the 21st century, having knowing exactly how things wind up working out, we have this tendency, I think, to often judge historical actors, based either on our 21st century moral compass and our sensibility, these types of things, or just like, because we know how things are going to turn out, and so he should have done something differently so we could get it to the conclusion which we wish would have happened. And I always tell them, I go, we really historians should think less about that and more about understanding the circumstances in the context in which they live and the circumstances they face, so we can figure out why it is they made the decision that they make. Whether it be a decision that we know is going to backfire, or whether it's a decision that's morally reprehensible, whatever that might be, we have to understand why we made that decision, right? As a historian. Now, as a human being, if we want to be judgmental about why people do what they do, I suppose that's fine. But as an historian, I think that we have to put on a different hat. You know,
Indeed.
and maybe, you know, and you know, we can look at, you know, we can look at moral judgments of the time, I think, because there were plenty of them, and see
Yes.
what, and see why they were doing what they were
Right.
doing. Now you bring up Gettysburg, and of course, you know, I'm gonna get into that. And you brought up Meade especially. I'm gonna bounce this off you. What do you think of this? I've sort of recently adopted this idea that a lot of people, when they write about the Battle of Gettysburg, they take this sort of, they frame it almost as if it is Robert E. Lee's battle to win. And if it were it not for a couple of mistakes, and this kind of, you know, works well with our conversation, were it not for a couple of mistakes from his senior commanders, whichever ones, whether it's Ewell or Longstreet or whoever, were it not for those mistakes, then he would have won because he had every advantage on his side. And then, and when I hear that argument, which I hear all the time,
Yes.
all the time, I hear that argument. When I hear that, I always go, well, what about George Gordon Meade? You know, I mean, he did some things,
Yes. He
you
played
know,
a little role.
he played a small, and I think that, I don't know if it was Pickett that said this after the war, but when it might have been Pickett, the story might be complete BS, or it might be getting the wrong person. But if I remember correctly, somebody asked Pickett, why is it that his charge failed on the third day of Gettysburg? And he responded, I think the Union Army had something to do with it.
Yes,
Right?
a little bit.
And so I think that George Gordon Meade, you know, with his decision to stay and fight when he could have moved off back, I mean, back to a different position. He had originally
Yes.
wanted to the Pipe Creek decision. He wanted to fight there.
Right.
If he had
Right.
moved to that disposition, if his, you know, he could, he had councils of war on the night of the first and the night of the second,
Yes.
where they
Yes.
debated what to do. And yet he decided to stay, and he decided to fight it out on that spot. And that decision, I believe, there has a lot to do, I think,
Oh, no
the
question.
outcome of that battle. But we don't think about that. And I
No.
think it's because of what you said, you know?
Right. And the other piece is, you know, he's criticized for having councils of war. I mean, give the guy a break. He's been in command for 3 days. He has never commanded. It's the worst timing of his life because he got what he wanted. And how many times does someone get what they wanted and it turns out horribly? And he's asking for advice. You know, now maybe he had a pretty good idea what he wanted to do, and some will say that. We don't know. But I see no problem with soliciting advice. But some historians say, oh, no, that was horrible. He shouldn't, you know, he's indecisive. And quite frankly, you know, this whole thing about the Pipe Creek line, maybe, you know, maybe he is considering pulling back. Is that a horrible situation if he thinks that that is a better defensive line? But, and even, you know, you mentioned Pickett's charge. And I hear this a lot, how stupid, how silly Lee was in launching that charge. But if you understand the whole dynamics of what was going on in that battle, you have a different perspective. You know, I've written several articles on Ambrose Wright's charge on July 2nd,
Right,
where
where he found and softened up the middle, right?
we're in one brigade, about 1,500 guys, actually captured Cemetery Ridge with you know, with a very small force. And Lee is saying, okay, I've tried the left, I've tried the right, let's try the center. In fact, here it was successful. And he didn't know that the artillery was not going to be effective. I mean, when you bring up 150 guns and they start firing for over an hour, you know, you're sort of expecting that that's going to have an impact. And then the other, and so many people don't quite understand this, I find, that Lee could count. And what I mean by that was Lee realized he was, the longer the war went on, the less likely he was going to be successful. So he needed to develop, that's why he always wanted to be on the offensive. He was great on the defensive, but he knows he's not going to be able to deliver a decisive blow against his adversary. And so the only way he feels he can do it is an offensive thrust to destroy the Union Army and maybe end the war. And he's not going to get that done at Gettysburg without some massive attack. So I'm not going to judge him and say, oh, it was silly. This was a man who was very savvy, who was very experienced, and he didn't make that decision lightly.
Do you think when I take my students there and I ask them this question, we go out, we kind of we set ourselves up where North Carolina was, kind of right in front of the Virginia Monument, strangely, that's where the Virginia Monument is where North Carolina was. But we march out into the field a couple few hundred yards. And we look across at Cemetery Ridge there, and we look at where the copse of trees is, and we look over where Little Round Top is. And we sort of march into the field, and I ask them to observe the undulations in the field. The highs and lows across there, because the criticism is always, why would you launch that attack across, roughly a mile of open ground where you're vulnerable to fire from all of these different spots? And then I take them out into the field and I have them observe that, and they go, "Oh, you can't see us from here and here and here and here when we're in this position of the battlefield." Do
That's
you think
right.
that made a difference in this decision?
I think that was partially part of it. He didn't know where the Union guns were. I mean, you had McGilvery with, I don't know exactly, maybe 30, 40 cannon further to the south. He didn't know they were there. They weren't firing at the time when the cannonade occurred. He knew there were guns on Cemetery Hill, Union guns on Cemetery Hill, but he was expecting that Ewell was going to be launching his attack and diverting that attention. Ewell happened to attack earlier in the morning. So, there were a lot of other reasons why Lee thought he was going to be successful. He did he, if I take 150 of my cannon and I'm aiming them right in a concentrated spot, and it looks like when he finally launches the charge, actually it's Longstreet, it looked like the Union Center had been destroyed. So it's so hard to analyze. And in the fog of war, you've got a frustrated Lee anyway. I mean, he's dealing with Richard Ewell, he's dealing with AP Hill, who are not Stonewall Jackson.
No, they're
And this
not.
is a man who does not like to give direct orders. His philosophy is, I get my army to the battlefield and I let my senior officers do the rest of the job. Well, that's fine with Longstreet and with Jackson, but it's not going to work with an AP Hill or a Richard Ewell who's totally inexperienced. And if he says to them, those two, take that hill if practicable, guess what? They're going to take that hill because they know that it's not a yes or no, or a discretionary order. It's basically take that hill. But for Richard Ewell, it's, oh, okay, well, my men are tired. I got another division coming up. It's not practicable, so I'm just going to wait a little bit.
Yeah, and it was also the nighttime was coming on. He didn't know where
Yes, right.
several corps of the Army of the Potomac were. And so that I don't know, he probably thought, if I take it, I don't think I'll be able to hold it. He maybe, in his mind, he made the right call on that point.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't want to criticize Richard Ewell, but he certainly was not a Stonewall Jackson. And I do believe that Lee needed to have a heavier hand. I mean, AP Hill basically said, I can't support Ewell's attack because my men are tired. And Lee basically says, well, that's fine. The way Lee would generally discipline his generals was usually to send them away to another theater of the war. If he did not think that they were performing well, he wouldn't demote them. They would be sent west. So he's sending his problems to some other army. And he did have a blind spot. And the, and you know I always say, when I think about what's going on at Gettysburg, he wanted the attack early in the morning of July 2nd. If it happened on July 2nd, the Fifth Corps was not up, the Sixth Corps was not up, and he's getting all kinds of grief from Longstreet, from Ewell, from General Early. And I think by the end of the day, when Longstreet realizes that the flank is not, the Union flank, the left flank is not where he thought it was, he's so frustrated. I'd be frustrated. It's God damn it, do it. Attack where you're not going to delay any longer. But for Longstreet to have said, there are apologists for Longstreet recently, well, I can't attack because one of my eight brigades, Law's brigade, is it's coming, but it's not here. and I'm going to have to wait. Well, to me, that's a little lame. But Lee says, that's fine. We'll wait until he comes up. So I think Lee's biggest problem sometimes was himself. I don't think he was as assertive as he should have been. And I don't think he supervised some of his subordinates as closely as they needed. The AP Hill needed as much supervision as he possibly could get, and he just wasn't getting it from Lee.
Well, that puts a dent in Lee's armor a little bit. I mean, the post-war, even at the time, those who put Lee up on a pedestal as this sort of peerless, peerless general, unmatched in either army when it comes to his military prowess. That's really kind of putting a dent in his armor. I suspect that you've read, you mentioned some Longstreet apologists. I suspect you've read Corey Farr's recent two books on Longstreet, which I found very interesting. He goes after Lee in that, in the defense of Longstreet. I thought the books were interesting. He was on the show a couple of years ago, and he and I disagreed on some stuff, and so I brought him on the show and we talked about it. He's a great guy. I loved having him on. And of course, I always love it when I have people on that I disagree with because we can find it out in public. It's fun. But what are your thoughts on that stuff? On the school that sort of comes to Longstreet's defense and say that we need to reevaluate his role at Gettysburg because he also often gets so much grief, and it's true he does get a lot of grief, and some of that grief I think is post-war political grief.
Oh, I
You
agree
know,
with you. Right.
and so what are your thoughts?
I think what Corey did was well needed. I think most of his arguments, I think, were well founded. I think there were some things where there was especially in the second book, was a bit of a stretch. I'm never going to say that Lee was the greatest of, without any chinks in his armor, but I think he was a pretty darn good general. And right now, my second book, Maps of Second Bull Run's coming, book's coming out. But a couple years ago, I wrote one on the wilderness, Maps of the Wilderness, and one on the Maps of Spotsylvania. And here you have Grant coming east, general in chief, with a gigantic Union army. I mean, we're talking about 120,000 men. And who is he up against? He's up against Lee, who has maybe 42,000, 43,000 men at the beginning of the Wilderness campaign, because Longstreet has not returned yet.
That's right.
And I think any other general probably would have held back, but not Lee. Aggressively, he drives these two corps through the wilderness, attacks brutally, attacks Grant, well, I should say Meade, in the wilderness. And what Grant was trying to do with his vaulted, and I go back and forth on Grant. I think he did very well in 1862, 1863. I think by 1864, when he's general chief, he's trying to end this thing, and he's going to use as many men as he can to against Lee. Didn't matter how many losses he had. But his goal, as you know, is to get Lee out into the open. So if he can get through the wilderness, he's going to get him in the open. He's going to destroy him. Well, that's in May of 1864. He gets him out in the open in Spotsylvania. What happens? Lee more than holds his own. He's got the size of the army. He almost destroys the Second Corps at the North Anna, and Cold Harbor. I mean, here he is right in the middle, out in the open. Yeah, he's got some defenses, and he's going to hold the line there. He has some breaches, but the key, as I see it, what makes Lee, I think, brilliant, is what happens at Petersburg. He's got this gigantically long line, defensive line. He's outnumbered, and his army is going to survive. From June, July, August, September, October, November, December, January, February, March, and then finally is going to have to succumb. But I don't know of any other general that could have held back that Union army, that massive Union army, as long as he did. So I'm not going to be one who's gonna. I think Lee had problems. There's no, he's human. But overall, I believe that he was one of our greatest leaders. An ability to use very meager resources to achieve a goal that he almost did it. Lincoln was almost convinced that there was no way he was going to be reelected in 1864. And Lee could had a major impact on that, but Grant was not going to let that happen.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned that because we just covered that in my Civil War class at my school. We just covered the election of 1864, and I taught them about the Blind Memorandum, and I taught them about the early summer of 1864 and the casualties that were stacking up, and that Lincoln was convinced.
Yes.
I personally think he was convinced he was going to lose,
Right.
going to lose re-election, and so worked very hard to preserve the Union before the following year when the president-elect would then take. What does he say in the Blind Memorandum? He'd be elected on the grounds that we couldn't save the Union after he took office, something along those, I'm paraphrasing, but something along those
Right,
lines.
right.
But no, I always thought that, and it's, I know it's not always fashionable these days to say things that point out Lee's virtues,
Yes.
because in our political world, he's on the wrong side of things. And I guess
Yes.
personally, I would agree with that. But at the same time, you have to say that, the man really was talented. He was a very skilled individual, both on the offensive and on the defensive, as you
No
pointed out, and I
question.
believe rightly, up against what seemed insurmountable odds. He still fights on almost, I think, personally, again, this is just me kind of, quarterbacking this on the Monday morning, but still, I think that he
Yes.
came close to winning this in the summer of 1864.
Oh,
Long,
I agree with you.
a full year
Yes.
after Gettysburg, when people say, well, there's the turning point, right? Now, a full year. Now I'd love to hear your thoughts now in popular memory, especially for those who haven't really gone deep in Civil War history. Of popular memory, Gettysburg is it's all done for the Confederacy in July 1863. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely not. I mean, as long as Lee had, I mean, at his high point in at Spotsylvania, when Longstreet returned, he had his entire army. He probably had, and this is actually on the 6th of May, so probably around the second day at the Wilderness. He's got about 60,000 men, so he's got half of what Grant had, and he performed superbly. So I don't think, I do not believe that it was a foregone conclusion that Grant was going to be successful. And one of the things that people who have written about Lee, and you see this a lot during the Overland campaign, and that is how Lee was able to take all, we don't realize this unless you're a military, in military intelligence, the Union Army, the Confederate Army leader is going to be bombarded with all this information about where the where and it's all oftentimes conflicting, but you're getting massive amounts of information from many different sources, and how do you distill that into this is where the enemy is and what the enemy might be thinking about doing? Lee was a master at being able to pick through all of that, what seemed to be disparate information, and coming up with this is where I think he's going to be attacking. This is where I think we're going to be most vulnerable. And that's why, whether it's a Wilderness, Spotsylvania, North Anna, Lee was always anticipating what Grant's next move was. Now, he had a misstep once or twice, but he quickly recovered. He was able to understand that Lee, Meade and Grant are sliding. They're going to slide. And one of the master points is when on July the, not July, let me go back to May. It is May 7th. It is the day after the Battle of the Wilderness. When Lee, he's picking up all this information, he says, I think that Grant is going to be sliding around my left flank, and I better do something about it. Well, I'm sorry, his right flank. And that's when he sends Richard Ewell out to go over to Spotsylvania Courthouse to meet him, beat him to the punch. And he was right. And, but if he hadn't, it would have been a whole different story. And so Lee was always anticipating what the enemy was doing as long as he had the information. At Gettysburg, we know that Stuart let him down, and he wasn't getting the information he needed to make those intelligent decisions.
Right.
But
And
I
so he has the ability, I guess, then to intuit, in fairly remarkable ways what his enemy is up to. And that, I think, is
That's
one of
right.
his great skills. And that's something he demonstrates those skills in the summer of 1864 before he is forced back into a siege position. I think he demonstrates
Right.
those skills almost all of the time, fairly
Yes.
well. So my question then becomes, why is it that in the world of popular memory, we don't look to that summer and we tend to fixate on the 1863 summer as the summer that made all the difference? That seems, and even like, even though we have, Vicksburg in the West, right? We don't even look at that one, which is probably, if you are asking me, I think probably maybe the more important loss
Oh,
for
I
the
agree.
Confederates was Vicksburg, not Gettysburg. Gettysburg, to me, strikes me as a the failure to achieve and accomplish some particular goals they had set and then didn't do it. Vicksburg is the
Right.
loss of the city, loss of the army, loss of the Mississippi River, essentially. That's a much more devastating loss. And yet,
Yes.
as an, as part of our American culture identity, whatever you want, we always tend to fixate on the summer of 1863 in Southern Pennsylvania. What is it
Yes.
about that battlefield that is so compelling for
Yeah.
everybody?
Well, I think, it being the largest battle in the Civil War, I think that certainly helped. I think because it was in the North, it affected the psyche of the country in a way that Vicksburg or Fredericksburg or these other battles didn't have the impact. I mean, we talk about 9/11, you remember about 9/11 and how we felt so afraid that what was the next shoe? Where was it going to fall? But that only lasted for maybe, a few days. And then we realized nothing was going to happen. But imagine you live in Pittsburgh or you live in Connecticut, and Lee's army is on the move and it's heading toward Pennsylvania, and it's not a few days, it's going to take him a month to get up there. And every day the news is being bombarded with Lee is coming, Lee is moving. And I think that had a traumatic impact on the population of the North, for one thing. And I think many of the soldiers, when you think about it, they wrote so much about Gettysburg. That was the most important battle for them. Partly it was really the first major Union victory that they achieved, at least in the East. And they're going to emphasize that. So I think there's a variety of reasons. I think the human psyche, the worry, the trauma. I think that many of the soldiers really did reinforce it themselves. Not the Southern soldiers, obviously, but the Northern soldiers certainly emphasized it because finally we won. We finally won a battle. Now you can say that Antietam was a Union victory, but it wasn't nearly as clear cut as what you found at Gettysburg.
And I found that when I'm looking at the monument dedication speeches, and I spent a lot of time looking at those, and they seem to emphasize over and over the Union ones. They seem to
Yes.
emphasize over and over that it was at that point, and this is after the fact, this is in the 1880s and 1890s, the early 20th century, when they're putting these monuments in place. And it's
Right.
and they say over and over again, it was at that point that we ended the rebellion, stopped treason in its tracks, and go on to talk about where they turned. Put slavery on a course of extinction, which I
Well,
found
see
pretty
here.
interesting. Go
There you go. There
ahead.
you go. If you were, and I've been told, because I will say there is one turning point of the Civil War, and I've been corrected. People have said, no, there are several turning points of the Civil War. You can't say one. But if I had to say one, and I have to say I'm a little biased because I'm an Antietam battlefield guide, but there is no question in my mind the most important turning point of the Civil War was not Gettysburg, it was not Vicksburg, it was Antietam and the Maryland campaign because of the
Emancipation
Emancipation
Proclamation.
Proclamation.
Yes, sir.
And and what happened after, as a result of it, England and France say, not so much, we're not coming in on the side of the Confederacy. If England and France had come in on the side of the Confederacy, it would have been over. And I always ask people when I give a tour, could we have won the American Revolution without France? And I think it's pretty obvious we couldn't. Could Lee, could Jefferson Davis, could the South have won without England and France? Yeah, they could have. You know, if the Union population said not so much in 1862 in the midterm elections or the presidential elections in 1864, if they said, we're done with this. We don't want a war. We're not going to fund the war. We're voting Democratic. It would have been over at that point. But I think the key is that by England and France not coming in, it assured that it was not going to be an easy victory for the South, and it was going to be drawn out longer. You know, when the Prime Minister of England said, "Well, we want you to win one more battle, preferably in the North, and we're ready to broker a peace." We don't know what that means. Probably breaking the blockade, could be sending troops to fight, you know, alongside the Confederate soldiers. But to me, if you're going to talk about what was the turning point, it's 1862, not 1863, because Lee was still very potent. And I heard a report, and I haven't seen it, I haven't tracked it down, that said that Lee was actually considering another invasion in 1864, but that Grant sort of beat him to the punch. We don't know that. We don't know, you know, Lee was not very good about writing after the war. And during the war, even like the Maryland campaign, he never explicitly said, here's where I'm going. He talked a little bit about why he's going to be invading the North. Obviously, supplies. He wanted to get Maryland on the side of the Confederacy. But he's not really that explicit. He's not a political general. And he's not as explicit about his motivations as some generals are.
Well, you know, I mean, I tend to agree that that is absolutely a significant turning point. I think once you have emancipation on the table, you have an entirely different war. You go from a war that's fought to preserve the Union to a war that's fought to preserve the Union and end slavery. Now there's something, and I'm, you
Yes.
know, I sometimes I think that we give too much to the emancipation part and not enough to the preservation of Union part, because we have to remember Union soldiers were very determined to preserve the Union. But with that combined, those two pieces together, I think it's a very important turning point. Now, I've often thought about the re-election of Abraham Lincoln in 1864 as something that at that point, I don't see how, I mean, it's all over for the Confederacy after that, because it, to me, the 64 election is a referendum on the war. A vote against Lincoln is a vote to figure out some other solution, and maybe even a vote, maybe if you go as far as the Copperhead position, let the rebels go, let them keep their slaves, we're not interested in it anymore, or a negotiated peace that involves like some sort, maybe getting rid of the Emancipation Proclamation, maybe creating some sort of second, you know, some second tier of permanent labor class for black, who knows what that could have been, right? Could have been a million things,
Certainly.
but you know, but emphasizing the preservation of the Union part at the expense of the emancipation part. And I think the Democratic Party, the Democrats of 1864, were very interested in doing something like that. And so that to me seems like, you know, that's a point of no return, I think, for the rebel 64. But yeah, this is one of those kind of things, you know, there's so many ways to come at this that it's
It's
fun to
true.
have. I argue with my students all the time when we were talking about the Gettysburg not being the turning point. I'm thinking of one student in particular, and she and I argue all the time about this. Very bright kid, you know, and she's got great ideas, but we're constantly arguing. My best students are the ones that argue with me, right? Those are always consistently my best students, and we argue all the time about this kind of stuff, which is absolutely great. Let's talk about your maps. Now, I've got a bunch of your books here. I've got this is one of my favorite, The Artillery at Gettysburg, one
Me
of your older
too.
ones. Yeah,
Me
and
too.
I also like, and I look for it, and I can't find it. I have it at school. It's the Brigades of Gettysburg.
Yes.
I'm a very ambitious fellow, and I hope one day, I've got the first day pretty well locked, but I hope one day to be able in my head to put all the Brigades of Gettysburg on the map. Wherever I happen to be, I can talk about what brigade was fighting right here in this particular place.
Sure.
But what I
Sure.
really love is this, the maps of Gettysburg. This is a beautifully, by the way, color illustrated for our YouTube people. You can see that the maps are all nicely done in here. And I use this when I read. And this is, I know I'm just kind of next level geek stuff, but I love maps. And so what
Me
I
too.
wind up doing is when I read like Fonz, or if I read like the old Coddington stuff or any of the military campaign stuff, what I'll do is I'll have the book, I'll be reading the book, I'll open up my Google Maps, right? So I can get a modern satellite view of what's going on. So I can recognize where today's roads are and the historic roads, and I can see where they're different. Modern buildings and stuff, so I can situate stuff in my mind. And then I open up this book and I have it on my desk next to me, and I put it right next to the Google slides,
right.
or the Google Maps. And I know it's just kind of a lot, but it's a really great way to figure out where everybody is. Now, when I go to the battlefield, my students always ask me, "How do you know?" Like I take the seventh. I follow in the footsteps of the 7th Wisconsin. For the first day, first division, first corps, first, you know, all that, and I read that piece from Bruce Catton, that few, like, right before the first corps, you know, takes a left across the fields and heads towards the Lutheran Seminary, you know, and that beautiful piece that Bruce Catton wrote, as they're all lined up, just a wonderful. I read them that, and then I go and I follow the footsteps of the 7th Wisconsin. Into the railroad cut and all that stuff. And then my students go, "How do you know exactly here?" And I go, "Well, I mean, I've done a lot of reading. There's that. But then I have to go, well, how do the people that wrote the books that you've read, how do they know where these guys were?" So I'll ask you, how do you know, since you're the one that made the maps on all this, the maps that I use, by the way, in my classes, how do you know?
I'm in trouble.
Yeah.
A lot of it is conjecture. You know, you're going to hate that. But what I don't do any longer, and I guess I used to when I was younger and feistier, but I'd have people come up to me with one of my maps in their hands, and they say, "You're wrong. That 7th Wisconsin was not here. It was a eighth of an inch over." And it's, you know, we know approximately where they were. You know, many of these soldiers left pretty detailed information on their location, their route of march. Sometimes they'll talk about the vegetation. Sometimes they'll talk about the streams. Sometimes they'll talk about the hills and the elevations. So you get a pretty good sense of it. My biggest problem, I have to tell you, is when I'll have two accounts and it was, they're in the same unit. Maybe they were side by side almost. Mm-hmm. And one is saying, "We went over to the left," and another is saying, "We went over to the right." In other words, they're not lining up. And I see this all the time, where who do you follow? Who do you believe? And that's where a lot of my critical thinking skills will come in, where I'll look at the terrain and I'll look at the enemy, where the enemy soldiers were. And I'll say, and also I'll look for some corroborating information. And oftentimes I have to make a determination that may or may not be correct. And what I try to do is put that in the end notes to say, here's what I'm dealing with. I have a situation where Second Bull Run, you know, that's the maps of Second Bull Run's coming out. And everybody seems to think that, you know, this is Stonewall Jackson in the unfinished railroad cut, excuse me, and we know exactly where the units were and who's fighting what. And it is amazing how you have a difference of opinion of an entire brigade, whether it is further to the north or to the south. And, you know, I've had two very distinguished historians that have written about where this, I'll give you the name, his name is Carr, Joseph Carr, where his brigade was. Some say it was way to the right of the Union line, some say no, it was toward the middle. And everything hinges on that particular unit, because you get a sense of where the other units were in relation to that one. And in this case, I said, what am I going to do? Who do I listen to? Because in both cases, there's some information that would support both. And I sort of took the easiest route, I asked the Rangers at Second Bull Run, and I said, you know, which one would you go with? And these are people that are living the battle all the time, number one. And number two, they're the ones who have to approve my book if it's going to go into the bookstore.
Yeah,
so,
that's right.
So if I get it wrong, it ain't getting in the bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're the ones who are say, well, told me, use this source. This is the Bible. This is the one you want to listen to. And so I wish I could, Keith, say, you know, we know exactly where every unit is. Sometimes it's simply conjecture. In some cases, and it's interesting, when you get to Cold Harbor, where there's not a lot of accounts, you know, a lot of guys at that point, the literate ones oftentimes were gone. Either they had been wounded or maimed or dead. And many of the other guys were not writing at that point. I mean, it was a horrible time. They're not writing letters and diaries for the most part. We don't know where units really were. And so we know where approximately the brigade was. And either you fill in and you say, okay, here's where the brigade was without, and you show the regiments, but you don't put the designation of the regiments, or you might have one where you know where it was in relation to the others, but you know, you have to make a determination. Do you add the designations for the others or not? Oftentimes I don't. Oftentimes I'll just have just rectangles, you know, representing a regiment, because we don't know where it was. We know approximately where it was, but not exactly. And that's going to have, you know, people want it to be exact. They want to open a map and be able to say, I know exactly where the 7th Wisconsin was. And I wish I could do that, but I can't. Nobody can. And even today, you know, in a battlefield today, you would not be able to do that. Unless you have, and you know, that's why Batchelder was at Gettysburg was different than the others, because, you know, veterans would come with their stake, remember? Mm-hmm. And Batchelder would have a veteran from the 7th Wisconsin come over. Okay, tell me where the left flank of your regiment was. And he put a marker down. And where's the right flank? He put a marker down. It's the only battlefield that I'm aware of where the flank markers are there. Now, if you look at them, some of them are the distance between them is very short. It's like, wait a minute, there were 300 guys in that unit, and we're talking maybe 40 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And also many times they're coming back and it's maybe 15, 20 years after the battle. And they're also coming back with different information because they think that they, oh yeah, it was here. But then the next week, his buddy comes over and says, no, it wasn't over there. It was over here. So Batchelder also had to make determinations. And I think he's the first who's going to tell you, this is the approximation. But it's close enough for someone like yourself, hopefully, to be able to open up my book and look at the text or fonts or one of the others and be able to get a better sense of where those units were. It may not have been exactly where they were. With all the smoke and all of the chaos, you know, there was one Confederate colonel, I'll never forget this quote, who said he was in many battles, but in the middle of a battle, he couldn't see more than 10 feet on any side of him because of all the crazy smoke, white smoke, because of the black powder.
Mm-hmm.
So it is probably one of the most frustrating parts of writing, you know, these map books. But it's, you know, when I hear you talk about it, it makes it all worthwhile, because what I'm trying to do is really visually show where these units were to the best of our knowledge. And it's working.
Yeah. And the kids, you know, my students enjoy looking, you know, looking over, holding the maps in hand and being able to walk in close approximation to the footsteps. And then, you know, I wonder sometimes if, you know, but you mentioned the flank markers. I wonder sometimes in the monument positions, especially,
yes,
if veterans came to the field with a particular agenda in mind and wanted to be positioned on the battlefield a little, you know, 10 yards ahead of the regiment that was next to them. And, you know,
yes,
sort of a little bit of a flex of the muscle, you know, and I wonder how much of that distorts
constantly,
you know, kind of where we see everybody on the battlefield.
One of the first book I actually wrote was Stopping Picket. the history of the Philadelphia Brigade. And there is a story that I learned while I was writing that book that is just amazing. And it's about the 72nd Pennsylvania, 72 Pennsylvania. And I don't know if you remember or know the story, but this was a unit, they were strapping firemen. And but they did not have the best reputation as fighters. So they're it's July 3rd. It is toward the middle end of Pickett, Pettigrew, Trimble Charge. You know, their Armistead is coming up, and there's general, and they're up on up behind, you know, up higher up on Cemetery Ridge. The brigade commander of the Philadelphia Brigade, his name is Alexander Webb, will go back to them because the 71st Pennsylvania has vacated its position. The 69th Pennsylvania, the Irish regiment, is getting beaten up pretty well. He needs reinforcements. So he pulls his sword and he tells these guys, come on, follow me. And we're going to go back up to the wall. Well, these guys are looking up and looking over and seeing all these Confederates, hundreds of them, overwhelming the 69th Pennsylvania, and there's this big gap in the wall, and they're not budging. And he literally grabs the flag from the flag bearer, thinking, okay, if I can get that flag, I can lead them down to the wall. And the flag bearer is fighting them. They're actually fighting back and forth over the possession of this flag. Finally, Webb gets so frustrated, he knows he can't move this 300 man regiment down to provide the support, that he goes down on his own to fight the rebels or Confederates, and is going to get wounded in the thigh. Now, that's what happens. Eventually, they see all of these other Union troops descending on the area, and they say, oh, we better charge. Well, they're going to charge with everybody else. Okay. So they really were absent when they were needed most. It comes time to put up the monument. And the monuments are, you know, there's a commission that's going to determine where each monument goes. And the commission at Gettysburg says, you're going to put the monument up on the ridge because that's where you were primarily during this battle. You weren't up at the front line where you're supposed to be. You're back in the rear. That's where we're going to put you. And they said, no, we want it up by the 71st Pennsylvania, by the 69th Pennsylvania, because we got to the wall. And they say, no, we're not going to let you do it. They actually, some of the veterans actually in the after dark will start digging the foundation near the wall because they just want to put it up in the wall. Finally, it literally goes to court, and the court rules that the monument will go, overturns the commission, it will go by the wall. And every time I see that, and you know this monument, it's very dramatic. It shows a soldier holding the muzzle of his rifle, and he's, that's it. Well, that's fine, but that's not what happened. They were way back up on the ridge line. They would not budge. But if you go today, you're going to say, oh, look at the 79th Pennsylvania, right on the front line. Look at that monument. Those guys really did do a great job of helping to repel Pickett, when in fact, that was not the case. It had to be decided by a court in Pennsylvania as to where it was. So that happens all the time. For the most part, most units are going to accept that ruling as to where the monument is going to sit at Gettysburg. But occasionally, you're going to have the 72nd, like where they're not going to accept that. They want it. They want to be valiant. They want to be remembered as the heroes of Gettysburg, when in fact they weren't. And it's interesting because, and sometimes if you look at the first Minnesota monument, you know that one, where a big monument by the Philadelphia or by the Pennsylvania monument. And, you know, it shows them running, the soldier running to try to stop the Confederate attack, Cadmus Wilcox attack. But it's nowhere near where the actual fighting began, occurred. It's way back by the road. So you can't say, oh, well, that's where they were fighting. But if they put it where the actual fighting occurred, you wouldn't see it. You know, it would be way into the field. So they want it to be by the road, and you're going to see it as you drive by the road. It's very dramatic, it's very tall. And they deserve to have a very nice monument, but it's not going to be placed where it belongs because there it's about visibility. And so many of these monuments are going to be along roads, not because where these units fought, as much as they want visibility. They want people to be able to see these monuments.
So, you know what? It's the moral of the story, I guess, is when you're visiting places like this, you always have to remember that there's a lot that goes into this telling of the story, the telling of the story by veterans,
Right.
and how we interpret these sorts of things, 150 years later, when we
Right.
look at this stuff and the interpretation has changed a great deal. And I think that that's a great spot to end. Just with that in mind, when we visit these sites of historical significance, when we see the public representation, whether the National Park Service has done it or whether the federal government has done it or whether state commissions have done it, they definitely have curated that story in a way that sort of fits a narrative that they want us to hear. And that's, I think, the more. So with that in
Yes.
mind, Brad, I thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a real joy talking to you. I've had a great time.
Thank you. I did too.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Keith. I wish we could keep going, but it's been a
Yeah,
great experience. Thank
it
you.
has been a great. And when I'm in Gettysburg, we're going to have to connect and talk about what we can do together there, because I think we can do some cool stuff.
Sounds good. I look forward to it. Thank you.
All right, beautiful. Thank you so much.